Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I am Maria De Merzis.
I'm Gregory Kless.
And in this episode, we are coming back to a hotly debated topic at the moment, which is the move into the world of digital currencies by central banks. Here at The Sound of Economics, we've zoomed in a couple of weeks ago on the issue of the digital yuan and its geopolitical implications. And we want to come back to the wider issue, given the ongoing discussion about a digital euro at the European Central Bank and in other central banks across the world. Gregory and Maria, you have been writing about the issue already a few years ago when this topic became out loud in the debate around stablecoins, especially when the ill-fated project of Libra by Facebook was announced in pompa magna, as we say, in Italy, and then kind of crashed, at least in its original idea. And Maria, you have just published this week an opinion on the topic. Maybe one of you can start by explaining our listeners what are central banks' digital currencies and what's the difference with the money, for example, in my bank account or with coins and beans? And especially also what is the difference between central bank digital currencies and cryptocurrencies?
So basically, a central bank digital currency is just a digital form of a central bank currency. And I think the best way to understand that is to compare it with what you said, with deposit and bills and coins. So basically, for the moment, we have access to two types of money. Physical central bank currency, so bills and coins, the cash that you can use in shops. That's one side. And on the other side, we have private digital currency, which are the deposits, the money that you have on your bank account and that you can use with a debit card or that you can transfer to people or to businesses. So that's what we have for the moment. And basically, central bank digital currency is a way to combine the two, is a way to have money that is provided by the central bank, but at the same time is digital. And therefore, you don't need anymore to have coins and bills in your wallet.
Gregory, if I understand correctly, is it a bit more like when I go to a festival, sometimes they have tokens, you know, to buy beers, to buy food, and you need to exchange these tokens, and sometimes these tokens are stored on your phone. They are still euros, you know, but they are in the form of tokens because you don't exchange cash. Is that the same thing that you're speaking about?
I don't think so, actually. It's not the same thing, because a token is a private thing and you can only use it in that concert you go, right? You can't take that token and go to Deleuze or to any other supermarket and exchange it for this. So it's not widely acceptable. E-cash needs to be as close to central bank currency, as Gregory said, as possible. So it needs to mimic both the cash and the deposits. Right. And only then will it be a perfect substitute. And the cash, it means that it needs to be anonymous. And the deposit, it means that I can use it to make payments as widely acceptable as any physical euro or any electronic payment or credit card or anything. So I think that's different. The two features that I like to think of e-cash is the fact that it's anonymized. And we can talk about this later. And that it is still euros. It's not a token. It's not a crypto. It's not a dollar. It's still euros. If I have an e-euro, is the same as euro.
And I think one of the most important elements of the euro is that a euro is safe. As long as the central bank ensures that there is price stability, you know that a euro is a euro. While with private digital currency, and also even with deposit in your bank account, it's not always perfectly safe. If you have a bill of 100 euro, you know it will be worth 100 euro forever. While your money in your bank account, there is a bit of credit risk. Not a lot, actually, because we know it's guaranteed up to 100,000 euro. But still, it's private currency. It was issued by the commercial bank when the commercial bank made lending. Not a lot of people actually realize that, but it's not exactly the same. That's why actually a digital euro is important, because it's the only way, if cash disappears, to allow people to have this really safe currency.
Just to explain a little bit better, you are saying that the money that I have on my bank, it's somehow a private currency from the bank when I see it displayed on my current account.
Yeah, it's heavily regulated. Banks who issue those euros have to follow a lot of prudential regulation, a lot of rules, etc., that are dictated by the regulator and by the central bank. But it's a private currency. You don't really realize it because it's issued at par. So it means that for 1 euro issued by your bank, you can have 1 euro in physical central bank cash because you can always go to an ATM and take the money back. But this is really still a private euro. And basically, that would be the main difference. In that case, it will be really issued by the central bank, not by a commercial bank.
It's very subtle, huh? That's a very subtle thing to explain. I think perhaps one difference and why, you know, the e-cash isn't really 100% cash, to make it a little bit more tangible for our listeners, is that, you know, you have it in your pocket. And e-cash, you don't have it in your pocket. And, you know, if there is comfort in having money under the mattress, well, you don't have that comfort with having money in some bank account, even if that bank account happens to be at the central bank of a very respectable government, of a very respectable set of countries in the case of euro. It's just not the same thing. The feel factor of cash and the confidence that it gives is different. And that's actually the direction of the argument that Gregory is making as well, except that it is a little bit more technical because of an institutional regulatory issue, but there is, it just isn't a perfect substitute. I agree with that.
And so what forms this e-currency, this e-cash would take in practice? How would that work? I mean, you speak about full anonymity or like a certain anonymity of this. How exactly I would be able to use it?
I think it can take various forms, basically. So the most promising form, in my view, and the one that is mostly discussed by central bank at the moment, is simply to be able to open an account at the central bank. So that's the simplest. So you would just open an account at the ECB or more probably at the Central Bank of Belgium. And there you would just use this as a normal account. You would have a debit card, etc. That's the simplest way it can work. But there are other ways that are discussed, because this way the problem is that it cannot ensure full anonymity, because you will have an account and the central bank will know what you do with your money. While there are other forms that could exist, like, for example, an hybrid form between digital and physical, like, you know, a prepaid card, for instance, where you would have like digital euro and you would use this prepaid card, or it could be an app on your smartphone that could do that. The problem with that is that, okay, it could work, but in the end, it's not very different from the token you were mentioning before. In the end, you just charge token. The value is the same as a euro, but it's just a token that you have on your phone or a token that you have on a card. So it works a bit like a lunch voucher a bit.
Yeah, exactly. So, Maria, why would you need that then?
Before we come to that, because at the end of the day, I think this is the most interesting question. But before we come to that, if I may just say, yes, yeah, so, I mean, the most likely thing that will happen is that we will shift some money from our bank account into a bank account at the central bank. And as Gregory said, it's probably going to be your national central bank in whichever country you are in the Eurozone. And then you have a form of using that money when you go to the shop. Typically, in the digital world, it probably is an app. We're all going to have an app and we pay with that app. And immediately money will be deducted from the central bank, just like money is deducted when we use our bank card to pay in the supermarket, right? I think that's the issue here. But it also begs the question, so what's so different? Why do I need it and I just don't pay with my bank card, right? And here I just want to raise this issue of anonymity, because that was actually a very big motivation for having a digital payment at the central bank to mimic cash. The motivation was, you know, I want a digital form of cash. Right. And if the central bank cannot guarantee anonymity, either through technology or through some contractual agreement, because you could think of guaranteeing that anonymously, then I really think you're taking away a lot of the raison d'etre of the central bank digital currency, right? And then I think we come to your big question, you know, what is really the innovation here, right? And I mean, well, let's hear from Gregory first, and then I'll come back.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think sometimes I say that CBDC is just a solution looking for a problem sometimes. Because it seems that the acceleration of the research and of the discussion on this was, as Giuseppe said at the beginning, when Libra was announced, when the Facebook version of a stablecoin was announced. And it seems that the main fear of central bank and public authorities that they needed to do something digital in order to slow down the adoption of private digital currency like Bitcoin, but most probably like Libras, which are actually more dangerous for central banks, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is yet again a very kind of wide issue here, right? I mean, first of all, let me just tell our listeners that CBDC is central bank digital currency. This is the way that this is described in an acronym. So let's think about the smaller issues first, and then bigger issues second. The smaller issue is, well, I have a bank card, or I have e-banking, or I have a credit card, why do I need another solution? I also have apps now. I can pay with my Apple phone. What is it that this is different, right? First of all, they're not anonymized. None of this is anonymized. So if somebody wanted to find out how much I spend in Deleuze every week, they could, if there is a legal reason for doing that, right? So it's not anonymized. The other thing is that it's also private, so it costs. So there is an issue of costing here. Could it be that if we have a method of payments coming from the central bank, the cost to the consumer will go down simply because it is a big player in this game and can afford to have a low cost. And moreover, it's a public player, so they're not there for profit. Could it be that this is a good solution? What I don't understand is, why do we need a public solution for this problem? Why can we not encourage competition in that space and therefore find a private solution that is also interesting from the cost term? So I don't think it's the cost issue. So maybe then it's bigger issues. And that brings us to what Gregory talked about, which is, you know, the cryptos creeping in. Or perhaps even we are wanting to make the euro a little bit more popular outside the eurozone. And if you provide a digital solution, you make it more available.
If I may say, Maria, you're basically putting here two elements which go beyond the technicality that we discussed so far. So basically, there would be an interest in order to say what is the response of central banks to the booming and blooming of cryptocurrencies or stable coins and so on. And on the other hand, there is this idea that about the euro as an international currency. Is that also a motive for that, Gregory?
In my view, it's not that much, because if you take the two forms that I just discussed before, the form where you have an account at the central bank, I think you would authorize European citizens to have this account at the central bank, or maybe European firms. But I don't see the ECB allowing American citizens or Chinese citizens, etc., to open a bank account when they come to Europe or when they want to invest in Europe. So I don't know. I don't buy this. I think there is a lot of hype about increasing the role of the euro thanks to a digital euro. But when you look at it in practice, I don't see how it increases the global role of the euro thanks to a digital version of it.
So what this digital euro would be useful for?
I think the main reason, apart from the most political and cynical ones that I mentioned before, that we want to avoid a takeover from crypto and Facebook, I think the main reason for citizens to have this euro is basically to be sure that they will still be able to access central bank currency, even if cash disappeared. Because in some countries, and for instance, in Sweden, cash has almost disappeared. And that's why actually the Riksbank, the central bank of Sweden, is one of the front runner in this e-krona thing. So maybe that's a reason to do it. Because if you cannot have access to this, you only have access to bank deposits. You don't have access to the real thing, the government money anymore. And so I think that's a way for the government to provide that to citizens.
If I may offer a slightly different view, not because I necessarily agree with it, but because it's out there in the arguments, and I think it's important to reflect on it. The use of cash in Sweden right now is about 13% of all payments. So it's not disappearing, and it won't go any lower, I think. So cash will not eliminate. It's interesting, if you go to a Swedish website where they explain this digital transformation in cash, they have testimonies of people who are arguing, I will never want to go and buy drinks and pay with some form of digital money because I want to be anonymous. I will always pay cash. I mean, so they actually have this on there. All this to reinforce the idea that there is some intrinsic value in physical cash that no digital solution will provide. So that's point number one. And there is something to that, including the comfort that I said earlier on. Now, this internationalization of the euro argument, it may be true for the euro, but it might not necessarily be true for other big currencies. And this is where I think our event we had the other day on the digital yuan was actually quite interesting to add to this discussion. Because actually, the digital yuan is perhaps the most advanced digital currency of all central bank currencies right now. They are now in the phase of implementing it, actually. And the ambition is to use it for the Winter Olympics in 2022. So they're almost there. The digital euro is very far from it. Includes the dollar and the Bitcoin, which is the UK solution to it. So it may not be the ambition of the Eurozone to use the euro to expand that, but it may very well be the ambition of others to do that. And, you know, can you really prevent it from happening? I think to answer that question, and I think Gregory has really interesting views on this, is to go back and understand what is money and what isn't, and what is good money and what is bad money, you know? And I think there, if we start looking at it from that perspective, I think we'll have more of an understanding of what is the potential for the digital currencies issued by central banks.
If I may ask also another question, because we are discussing quite a lot about the advantages for citizens and somehow the motives of a central bank in order to do that. But we mentioned several times commercial banks, and we say this is almost like a competition to, like, why would I keep my money in my bank if I can have a digital currency of this kind? So what are the stakes over there for the commercial banking sector, how they are reacting to this?
Okay, I can just close my account, my commercial account, and just have one at the central bank, which, as Maria said, will probably be costless. They will provide this for free, actually, to citizens. So why would I open a commercial bank account? So I think, yes, that's a risk. And I think central bank, and in particular the ECB, are really aware of this risk. And they are really looking for solutions to avoid that risk. Because it would be, there could be actually positive effects. There could be negative effect, of course, of this disintermediation, but there could be also positive effect. But it would be a real profound change and a revolution. So they need to take that into account.
So what could those positive effects, but also coming back to one of the things that you just said, how can central banks mitigate these risks, Maria?
First of all, let me just explain what do we mean by risk here. I mean, I don't know if this is clear to everyone. Why is this a risk? I mean, if I could take all my money from my private bank and put it at the central bank so that I can pay things, why is that an issue for the society? Well, I mean, that reduces. Remember that the money that I keep in a private bank, the bank uses to invest. This is a role that banks play, and in the process, they pay me a little interest for it, right? This is what the task of the banks is, the intermediation task, right? If I was to take all this money out and bring it to the central bank, the central bank's role is not to intermediate. It will never intermediate. So that function disappears. So who's going to finance growth if we eliminate that part of the bank? So that's a very big risk. The central banks are very aware of that. In the public consultation that the ECB did, they were talking about a maximum amount of money put in the central bank of, I think, 2,000 euro or something, not more than that, just to limit that. But if every one of us put 2,000 euro in the central bank, that is money that is not being intermediated. So that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing for the economy. We want that money to be invested.
And what would prevent the central bank to invest this money in projects, for example, you know, instead of raising taxes, to invest in, you know, projects that are come back to the citizens?
It's not the role of central bank to do that. Eh? Remember what the role of central bank is. They're to protect the value of money at the very, you know, at the very end. It's you will have conflict of interest then, because in order to invest, you have to take risks. And that, of course, will there is a conflict of interest here that the central bank cannot play. The central bank will never do that.
And just to come back to the discussions we had before with Maria, I think, yeah, it could have a big negative effect if banks stop lending. Yeah, it's true that there is no way to finance the activity without bank lending. But you could also think that in the end, bank will continue to exist, but in a different form. They would not rely on deposit, but people would just put the money that they want to be invested. So they would not use bank account as just a store of value and a way to make payment, but they will use bank basically as investment fund. So bank would be very different. They could become like investment fund where you put only the money that you want to be invested in project. The money that you want to keep safe, you would put it at the central bank. So in a way, we don't know what would happen with that. It would be very different from now, but it could be actually quite positive, because actually this kind of bank, they would not be like too big to fail or things like that. So maybe you could just let them fail, because they would not be there to ensure the system of payment. So we don't know yet what it would look like, but I think we need to investigate that a lot to see what would be the different outcome, because there are positive and negative effects.
If I understand correctly, this war issue could be either something very marginal within the system, like some nice add-on and little pocket cash that you can have on the side in order to make some operations and be a handy, you know, addition. Or it can be something that is going to disrupt the system as we know it nowadays. So it's really it's really a debate from a zero sum to
Yeah, I fully agree with you, and I think actually that's why maybe central bank cannot take that decision by themselves, if you think about it. Because if it leads to a huge disruption and it's not just a technical issues, then maybe it's not central bank who should discuss that. It should be discussed by citizen, parliament, government, etc. So I think it's important to think it's like this.
It is very difficult to imagine central banks in our world to have been disruptive, right? So I think it's safe to exclude that. By nature of its statutes, central banks are not there to disrupt. They're there to ensure continuity and smoothness. So but then that brings us back to your other point, Giuseppe, but then is it really marginal? I actually think that maybe in the Eurozone or in the dollar zone or in the UK, the innovation here is much, much smaller. But if you are in a country where, let's say the financial sector is not well developed to ensure, you know, smooth function of the economy, trust in bank accounts, and you can trust, you know, national institutions a little bit more, maybe that offers more of an opportunity to promote something called financial inclusions, which basically means people having money in a bank account and they have access to payments that are safe. So I think it's important to differentiate the value of such an innovation in a world that has got so many options like ours and perhaps other societies that don't have quite so many options. In the Eurozone, I don't really think that it adds much as far as my welfare being is concerned. And the issue of financial inclusion is much smaller. The problem of financial inclusion in the Eurozone is much, much less. There is issues, but we have ways of addressing them in ways that you don't really have to have yet another institution, a central bank digital currency, to deal with that. So yes, I agree. I find in the Eurozone, the additional value is probably marginal, and it's much more catching up with technology rather than catching up with needs.
There is one last aspect that has been floating around since the beginning of this conversation, and we kind of left it a bit aside, which was the competition or not competition, or in any case, the relation of this conversation with the evolution of cryptocurrencies. We only touched it very tangentially, you know, that this is one of the points. So maybe since we are going towards the end of this episode, it will be good to explain also what are the stakes over there, because there is definitely, as we said, a connection between the two debates.
There are 10,000 cryptocurrencies currently in the world, right? So the 10,000 ways of what? Is that currencies? Is it a means of payments? My sense is that these cryptocurrencies are more assets and rather risky assets, actually, rather than money. Say, you know, ways of storing value, which is effectively what money is, right? It's also not very divisible. I can't pay with one Bitcoin to buy bread, right, in the baker, because it's just so much big value that I cannot use that. And it's also not widely available. I mean, it is available. If you and I agree to exchange something in Bitcoins, we could do it. But you and I can agree to exchange something with other means as well. So that doesn't really, is not as broad as you need it. So I think cryptocurrencies, despite the name, are more assets rather than actually money in the traditional sense of money. So I don't actually see them as contenders. I think it is the digital revolution of cryptocurrencies in the technology that created the development of technology that now allows us also to think of how can we do it also in central banks. So, you know, the distributive ledger, the verification process, all these things which were wonderful innovations in the way of exchanging anonymously value was actually there and it motivated the discussion also here. But they're not real substitutes in my opinion.
I agree with Maria. For the moment, they are not competitors and they look more like assets. And also, even the technology itself is still immature. It's not as efficient as the ones that we are using with normal money. It's slower and it's also much more energy inefficient. And that's a very important point in the current junctures. So yeah, they are not great competitors. They might be competitors later when you have a new algorithm, etc. But for the moment, I don't see them as competitors.
Yeah, I wanted to make just one comment. Again, the distinction between our societies and societies that are less financially developed can be of relevance here as well. If you live in a country where you don't have much trust in the currency because the inflation rate is so high and, you know, the value of the money in your pocket disappears, then maybe you want to rely owners of an outside currency that is available to you through technology, namely on your phone. You know, here is where Libra could have made a difference. In countries with very high inflation, everybody has an account on Facebook and therefore access to potentially the Libra. Okay, that project is now dead, but then you can see that really being of some interest to countries where the means of payments are not as reliable. In countries like the European ones, or the, we may call them the first world, where we have hugely sophisticated financial systems, it's very difficult to compete with sovereign currencies.
Yeah, exactly. As long as they do a good job and they ensure price stability, there is no real need. But it's true that actually it might be good to have it because it forces them to do a good job.
Well, in any case, we are going to come back to this issue for sure in one way or another here at The Sound of Economics, because we are running out of the time for this episode. I would like to thank both of you for this. I definitely understand much better what a digital currency issued by a central bank would mean and what will be the difference between that and a Bitcoin or whatever kind of token I have in my pocket to buy some beer at a concert. So it's definitely helping, hopefully, also our listeners to get, running through the maze of this debate, which, as we say, has a lot of ramification also in terms of geoeconomics and debates at global level about what is going on in the wider spectrum of currencies between the dollar, the euro, and the yuan. So this was very useful, and thank you so much for this. I would like to also to remind everyone that you can read the policy contribution by Gregory and Maria, which they wrote a while ago on the topic, as well as the opinion piece of Maria on the links provided in the show notes. And I would like to remind you that you can access the full library of analysis and studies of our experts on our website, www.bruegel.org. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.